Good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be gathered on this, the final event for the MLK Day of Service and Learning here at EMU. I'm curious, just simply curious, to see by a raise of hands, how many of you engaged with one of the activities today other than hearing Shane Claiborne speak? Hands up if you did. Looks like some great participation. Thank you. And if not, that's not a guilt trip thing. We're glad that you're here to hear Shane Claiborne this afternoon, and maybe you were here this morning as well. This lecture, this forum this evening, is funded by the Student Lecture Series from the Student Government Association, and we're so pleased to have the partnership of SGA to bring Shane to campus, and also for the Martin Luther King Day Planning Committee. And so I'd like to express appreciation to both SGA and the MLK planning team. Please. Let's focus our time to hear and engage with Shane Claiborne. He's a best-selling author, prominent Christian activist, sought-after speaker, and recovering sinner. With tears and laughter, Shane Claiborne unveils the tragic messes we've made of our world and the tangible hope that another world is possible. He writes and travels extensively, speaking about peacemaking, social justice, and Jesus. He's featured in the DVD series, Another World is Possible, and is the author of several books, most of which are on the tables right outside here. The Irresistible Revolution, this one used in some classes here at EMU, Jesus for President. Timely today with the inauguration, but this is for always, not just today. Also a new one, Red Letter Revolution. I like the subtitle. What if Jesus really meant what he said? And Common Prayer, the pocket edition, A Liturgy for Ordinary Radicals. He speaks over 100 times a year in a dozen or so countries. Told me that he and his wife Katie are leaving tomorrow for Thailand. And also nearly every state. And if we have our history correct, this is the third time within the last 10 years that Shane has come here to EMU to engage the campus community, and we're grateful for that. And so let's welcome Shane Claiborne.
But I've never been here on Dr. King Day, and it's been so beautiful. We were just saying that Coretta Scott King said, don't celebrate Dr. King by taking a day off, but by taking a day on, you know, to really do something that lives out his legacy. So it's been exciting to see all the little glimpses and snapshots of what we've been doing today. And also to anchor that action in reflection, you know. So I told Brian, I don't think we need to throw a bunch of new stuff on. We'll have a little time to think together tonight, but then we're going to open it up so we can talk together, because I don't think we learn as well through monologue as we do through dialogue. So we've kind of got a new model of teaching in Philly where it's always done in dialogue. So know that that's coming. That's why there's microphones up here. But just a little more that we'll chew on as we move towards the conversation is I discovered this quote as Dr. King, you know, I think what I see as I look at the later part of his life is you really start to see him having a larger umbrella than just race about what's happening in the world. And he's, you know, the poverty, the separation between rich and poor, the war in Vietnam. You know, at one point in the Riverside speech, he calls America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world because of our military buildup. And that all of those connections, it seemed like, are creating this web of justice. But in the end, one of the things that I love about Dr. King is that he wasn't just looking to legislate love. He knew that it had to begin with the changing of our own hearts. And in the end, we don't end segregation and racism through laws, you know, racism through laws alone. Like, you know, like we have to change our dinner tables. We got to change our friendships and our living rooms to where we reflect the kind of relationships that Jesus had. And so this is one of his quotes that I've held on to and I love a lot. He says, people hate because they fear. And they fear because they don't know one another. They don't know one another because they haven't communicated with each other. And they haven't communicated because their lives are separated. And that seems like what we do, isn't it? That we put up walls and barriers. Some of them are literal. Some of them are subtle ways that we insulate ourselves from each other. And yet I think the promise of Jesus is that the walls can come down. And so I thought we would look at one scripture as we think of the end of racism and segregation, but also the walls between rich and poor and between people that aren't, you know, don't have the same theology or politics. So whatever the walls are, this conjures up in your head. Now, this is a story that I never heard preached growing up. And it's kind of a little bit of a Debbie Downer. I mean, like it ruins the chi in the room a little bit. But it's the story of the rich man and Lazarus. And I'm going to read it, but and then we'll unpack it just a little bit. But this is the story. So Jesus said this. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, and he lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came, and they licked the beggar's sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died, and he was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I'm in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all of this, there's a great chasm that has been fixed between us and you, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from you to us." I told you it's a little heavy, right? But I think what parables do is they invite us to write a different ending to the story with our lives, right? It doesn't have to end that way. And I think that's what a great story does is it, you know, those movies where you get to see the alternative ending. That's kind of what I think our lives get to be in this story. And there's a few things that the early Christians point out as they love to preach on this verse. Folks like St. John Chrysostom, you know, the golden mouth preacher, one of the things that there's a whole book of his sermons on this little passage alone, but one of the things that he pointed out was that there's something interesting that happens with the names in the story, that for some reason the rich man isn't given a name, and the poor man Lazarus is given a name, and John suggests that, like, there's something to that the rich man probably lived his whole life with people knowing his name. The brother probably had a corporation named after him, or a town, a street name or something, right? And yet, like, in the story, he isn't given a name. And yet, the one who is given a name is a beggar that, you know, you think of all of the invisible people that live and die in the sewers and in the trenches, in the invisible places, the shadows of our world, and no one knows their name. And yet, that's the person who's given a name in the story. And his name means the one God heard and rescued. That's what Lazarus means. Beautiful, isn't it? And so, like, as you see this story unfold, what we see is that the rich man built up that wall, maybe in fear, you know, as Dr. King was saying, this fear, this insulation that he thought protected him, but eventually we end up seeing that the wall wasn't good for anybody, right? Like, he ended up not only locking people out, but locking himself in. And if you look at what we've done so often with in all of our fear, in our idolatry of security, as we build all these walls and picket fences and national security walls and, you know, defense shields and all of that, like, in order to protect ourselves. And in the end, we are enslaved to fear. And we end up, like, if you look at the studies over and over and over, they show that the wealthiest places in the world have the highest rates of loneliness, depression, and suicide. We're the richest, loneliest people in the world because we've robbed ourselves of the very thing we're made for. which is community, to know and to be made known, you know, and we live in all of our cubicles and insulate ourselves in all these ways. And I think even the digital world is dangerous. Though we tried to Skype Afghanistan this morning, like, and I believe in this movement of Friends Without Borders and doing Skype calls and all that with like kids in Gaza, like we're doing all that. But in the end, we got to be careful that our technologies don't replace real friendships, right? That we don't like, I got an idea, crazy idea. Don't just text someone to be your friend, actually ask them to, you know, like, because if we're not careful, like in all of our virtual friends, we'll end up really lonely people. Because like, if you only eat virtual food, you're going to die, right? If you only have virtual community, I think we're still going to be pretty lonely people. One of the things that Eastern did, I went to Eastern University without the Mennonite, the EU instead of the EMU, but always when people mistake us, I'm like, that's a very nice compliment. There's not many places I'd rather be mistaken for than EMU. But like Eastern did something really neat. They said to all the incoming students, they said, if you'll unplug from all technologies, all social networking and stuff for your first year, We'll give you all these benefits. And they gave all kinds of like really creative incentives, like a letter grade raise in one class or something like that. But anyway, I'm not sure how they pulled all this off. But anyway, what they saw was that the more that you'll unplug from all the virtual stuff, you can focus on the real stuff. Because there's people that aren't like you here. There's people that whose backgrounds you can learn from here. So like focus on the real community. So I think like whatever those walls are that insulate us, we've got to start tearing them down and see, like, I love that idea, the mix it up at lunch, you know, that today, and maybe every day is mix it up day, you know, but that like starting to get outside of our little comfort zones. And one of the other things that that the early Christians pointed out is that in this text, that between the rich man and Lazarus, you see that the rich man, it appears, was a religious guy, just like the guys this morning in the Samaritan story. But they didn't reach into the ditch, and neither does the rich man. He calls out Father Abraham. If you read on the story, he knows all the prophets. He knows the story, and yet his faith did nothing to move him in compassion, right, to the person that was right on the other side of that wall. So as we think of that, I think our faith gets ignited when we get outside of comfort. You know, I mean, I think of the few places where those times where I've felt like I'm in this liminal space, totally outside of anything comfortable, and like you see God move. You know, for me, being in Iraq and Afghanistan was that, like, but I don't think you have to go across the world. Sometimes it's when we go into a neighborhood that we're not familiar with, you know, and you see, like, your own faith come to life. And so those walls, let's you know, kind of think of them, because that's what segregation was about. That's what fear is about. And it's about this fear that we're not going to have enough, so we've got to stockpile for tomorrow. So that's why we end up with these patterns of super rich and super poor. You know, right now in Philly, we got like 40 schools going bankrupt at the same time that the suburban schools are getting smart boards where you like touch the board and stuff happens, you know, and like all the kids have like iPads, and there's something in us that aches, you know, as we do that. As we think of the inequity that exists in the world, sometimes we start talking with the kids in our neighborhood. And I thought it'd be fun to, since I can't bring you all to Philly right now, I can bring a little glimpse of Philly to you. So we were unpacking some of this very stuff that we're talking about today of racism and inequality, classism and stuff with the kids on my block. And I thought what they had to say was brilliant. So check this little video clip. It's us talking about the same things that we're talking about right here, but with kids on my block in North Philly. So here we are. We're at 3200 Potter Street in a house that we fixed up. This used to be abandoned. Did you guys know that? This is an abandoned house, and this is a space where we hope to have some computers and art stuff for the kids to come and hang out in. And so we're here now with a bunch of the kids from the neighborhood. And we're going to do a little game. You guys, we've been talking about why we have so much abandoned houses like this in a neighborhood where there's so many people who need housing. Where there's folks on the street and there's people who need homes, but then there's so many abandoned houses. And in the same way, there's a lot of people who need food and a lot of people who have extra food in their closet.
right? So this is the situation in our world. 20% of the people have 80% of the world's stuff. And that means 80% of the world has only 20% of the stuff. So here we are with the kids. We've got 8 on this side and 2 on this side, 80% and 20%. Now we're gonna divide up all of the food and toys and stuff. Deal? We just gave out school supplies in the neighborhood. Who all got school supplies? We gave out school supplies to about 400 kids. So let's look at what this looks like in our world. All of you would only get 2. And then you 2 would have all of these. That's crazy, huh? We got 10 of everything. So how many do you all get? 2. You would have to share 2 between all of you. And these guys would get all of those to play with, just the 2 of them. So we like to play Frisbee, right? You guys would have to share 2 Frisbees, and these guys would get 8. 35,000 children will starve to death today because they don't have enough food. Because what happens is you guys would get 2, and they would get 8. Folks need milk for their kids. You guys would get 2, and they would get 8. This is medicine here for a cold. So if we think about all the people in the world that don't have medicine, and that's what happens here, you guys would get 2, and they would have all of those. And it's getting ready to be cold, so some folks are going to be cold and only have 2 hats for all of you to share, while all of these hats go to folks over here. And see, they might even have extra hats in their closet that they could share with you guys. But they have all of this stuff.
And it's a shame because they do have all this extra food, and they know they do, and they also know that in the world, there's people that hardly have anything at all, and they just keep it, or sometimes even throw it away. We're gonna feel bad because while they're over there having fun and eating, and they're not cold and they're warm and they're having fun, we're over here starving to death, cold, and we can't play because we all can't share. We're supposed to share because that's what God meant us to do as stewards.
She's gonna be a preacher, right?
But we don't. Some of us have all this, and some of us have this little bit, and it's a shame because it really is like that. Mm.
All right, so what we got here,
I'll let you watch the magic trick, okay?
And this is God sort of pouring out all the stuff for us to share, all the food and things we spilled a little bit. And if we shared that, it might look like it ran out a little bit, but I think if we kept sharing and we kept thinking that there's enough in God's hands, that we would keep seeing it, and we would see like that as we think it goes empty, that there's enough, you know, it kind of refills as we were sharing all this. And it might even seem like, oh, there's none there, you know, it might seem like that's gone, but and it might feel like that's gone, but really, it just keeps coming and coming. So I think there's enough for everyone's needs, but there's not enough for everyone.
So I'll tell you how I did that after the session for $20. No, I'm just kidding. But you know that quote that was at the end was from Gandhi, that there's enough for everyone's need, but there's not enough for everyone's greed. And it seems that that's what's so important in all of this, is that God didn't create a world where there's not enough stuff or there's too many people. But indeed, there is enough if we live into the prayer of Jesus, right, which is this day our daily bread. Or as I love the proverb that says, give me neither poverty nor riches, for in my poverty I might be forced to steal, or in my riches I might forget my God. But there is enough. And that idea that we can build a world where everyone has this day their daily bread is not idealistic. It's actually exactly what God created and exactly what Jesus teaches us to pray for. And sometimes I think the kids get that vision so well. You know, we're teaching kids to share. You know, don't keep more than you need while someone else doesn't have anything to play with. Like, and it's sometimes it's almost that simple, isn't it? That the world's never going to be safe as long as masses of people live in poverty so that a handful of people can live however they wish. That's different from the dream that God had in mind, right? And I'm also reminded, as I think of Dr. King, I I think of how absurd he thought it was to continue to defend all of our stuff rather than to share it more abundantly, and that's what would build the beloved community, right? Is if we start to share stuff a little more. And St. Francis caught on to that, you know, as he said, the more stuff we have, the more clubs we need to protect it, because we start to realize that we're not building a safe world, so we'll just, like the rich man, we'll build up more walls, we'll get more bombs, we'll get more weapons. And right now, you know, it must break God's heart that right now the military spending in the United States is bigger than any place in the history of the world. It's $20,000 a second, every single second. It takes the next two dozen countries combined to add up to the same military budget. We have the capacity of almost 100,000 Hiroshima bombs. And so I know that can be pretty heavy. So I've gotten to know one of my friends that I think articulates this in a way that's neither takes away from the travesty of it, but also like kind of points us to a new possibility. And that's my friend Ben Cohen. He's one of the founders of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. A good friend to have, by the way. When I got married like 2 years ago, we had all the Cherry Garcia you can ever imagine. But anyway, I've gotten to know Ben, and Ben and I have like tag teamed. In fact, we got a project that we did together called Jesus Bombs and Ice Cream, and it comes out, you know, kind of officially next month. But one of the things that Ben does is he stacks Oreos to show how some of our spending adds up. So I couldn't bring him here today, but I got him in a cartoon version. So we'll watch this, and then we're gonna open it up for dialogue. Okay, so check this out, little cartoon with my friend Ben.
The federal budget affects everybody, but it's so big that nobody can figure it out.
Federal budget? What do I care?
What do you care? It's your money. And it's why college scholarships have dried up, our public schools are broke, and there's 12 million kids growing up in poverty. Well, these are serious problems. Now, I'm a dessert guy, so when I'm faced with a serious problem, I think about dessert. In this case, Oreo cookies. Let's say one cookie equals $10 billion. The Pentagon's annual budget is 40 cookies, or $400 billion a year. So how much do you think we spend on this other stuff? Not much. And that's why our schools don't work and children are left out in the cold. The government makes it sound like it's impossible to solve these problems, but it's not. Here's how we could do it. Just take 5 cookies a year off this pile. Use 1 cookie to rebuild our schools, 1 to eliminate our need for Mideast oil, and 2 to feed all of the 6 million starving kids around the world. Then take the last cookie, you've all done this before, and use half to provide health insurance and a quarter to provide Head Start for every kid that needs it. You can eat the other quarter cookie, but remember, that's $2.5 billion.
But that's gonna make our armed forces too weak. How are we supposed to pay for our nukes and our new jet fighters and submarines? We'll be vulnerable.
Vulnerable to who? Russia, our highest spending potential enemy, spends 7 cookies worth, and they're actually an ally. The military budget of China, the next highest spender, is 5 cookies, and they're a major trading partner.
What about the actors of evil? We need those cookies to help fight terrorism.
Those guys combined spend less than 1 cookie, not even a whole cookie. So, as you can see, it's possible to pay for all these social needs and still have more than enough left over to deal with these guys.
So, it may not be may not be quite as simple as the Oreos stacked up there or as the kids on our block, but it does seem that there's an innocence, right, that goes, we can do better than the world that we live in right now. And one of the most memorable moments for me when I was in Baghdad the first time, I was in Baghdad in March of 2003, almost exactly 10 years ago, during the bombing of Baghdad, with an incredible group of folks, and just there to be Christian peacemakers, you know, and to be doctors and nurses, volunteering in the hospitals and everything. And as we were there, the shock and awe campaign started, and the bombs started falling on Baghdad. And I saw, hands down, the scariest, most haunting things I've ever seen in my life. But I also, everywhere we went, we caught glimpses of people who knew that it didn't have to be that way. And one of the clearest glimpses of that was in one of the hospitals as the bombs were falling and the place was shaking. This doctor had a little girl in his arms whose body was riddled with missile fragments. And he put his hands up in the air and he said, "This is for a world that has lost its imagination." And those words like echo inside me almost every day, you know, that this is for a world that's lost its imagination. And so what I love about Dr. King is that he had a dream and he kept believing in that dream even when it killed him. He kept believing in that dream even when it landed him in jail. He kept dreaming that dream when it was unpopular. And It's my hope that I see glimpses of it everywhere, of folks that aren't willing to accept the world as we've been handed it, but who want to build the world that God dreams of. And I think that's exactly what following Jesus is about. It's falling in love with Jesus and then allowing Jesus to transform our lives so that we don't conform anymore to the patterns of this world, but we're transformed by the renewing of our mind, as Romans says. We've got a new imagination with how we live in the world. So may it be so. May we have that kind of imagination spark in us through days like today, through inspiration like Dr. King, and most of all, through the transformation of Jesus in our hearts and in our lives. So let's sit for a minute. Let's be good Quakers. We'll just sit for a minute, and then when it feels right, someone can come up and we've left plenty of time to unpack things. So if you have a thought or a question or something that was provoked in you, you can do that. But for just a minute, let's be still. I'm going to move down here, and you guys feel free to come up to either side and share anything that you got in your heart.
Hi, Shane. My name is David Evans. I teach in the seminary here. And I was moved by your presentation, and particularly I have the video of the kids, you know, 80%, 20%. And it just provoked this thought in me that so much of the way that we're taught to interact with those who don't have material wealth is that we're supposed to share or give to them, which in my experience often turns into kind of a paternalistic way of interacting. So I guess my question is, how do we think about partnering? We do build things, like we build walls. I think around here we tend to not think about building walls of wealth where we're separated, but we build programs. We build institutions, perhaps, maybe organizations to help those people. But I wonder if how we might begin to think about partnerships with people who don't have the kind of material wealth, access to the academic world that we do, and that kind of thing. I wonder if you might share a little bit about, you know, that, if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's an incredible thought, and it conjures up a few things in my mind, but the first of them is how different the early church thought about charity or generosity or giving. Like, in the early church, it seems that there was a deep sense that when we give to those in need, it's not a great noble gesture that we should get awards for, but it's actually something that only unveils how tragically we've messed up the world. And so, like Saint Vincent de Paul, who the great charity is named after, you know, the Vincent de Paul Society, he said, when I go and I give bread to the beggar, I get on my knees and I ask for forgiveness because I'm only returning what was stolen. And that's a pretty different way of looking at charity, right? And I think that what we've done is we've turned charity into a great virtue that only makes people feel disempowered if they're poor and makes people feel like they're heroes if they're rich. And there's something really intrinsically problematic in that, because I think we also like hide behind charity and we continue to, in some ways, write a check thinking that we've changed what's wrong, you know, rather than, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, we can't just keep lifting people out of the ditch. We've got to like drive a stake in the wheel that's running over people. Like we've got to not just swat at mosquitoes, but do something about the swamp. And so I think you make a lot of really great points. I mean, some of the most oppressive companies in the world do great charity work. Charity is very different from justice. And I think that it's also true that, like, a part of what, if we're not careful, we end up like celebrating people who move into neighborhoods that are poor at the expense of the people there. Let me give you a real quick example of that. One of my neighbors, who's become a good friend, he said, when you move into our neighborhood, all of your peer group think that you're a hero. When I don't move out of our neighborhood, everybody in my peer group thinks I'm a failure because everybody's trying to move out. And so that, like, there's something deep in there, right? There's all kinds of things, I think, that as we think about how we wrestle with so-called privilege and how we come alongside people. You use the word partnership a few times, and I think that's an incredible word that we've got to, like, when we started our community, we didn't see that we were not church planters or anything. We said we're coming in to join what God's already doing in our neighborhood. So we deliberately become a part of the local congregations around us. We jump on board with other organizations we can work with, which is what many of you are doing today, and what's so fantastic to see the Neighborhood Association, the United Way, you know, all these groups trying to work together. Because if we're not careful, we just do charity work and not justice work. And so we only care for the victims without changing the very system that continues to produce victims. And that's one of the things that Dr. King was explicitly critical of, right? So it's a good, good word. And I think we've got a lot more to do on that. But one of the starting points is anytime we give a gift to the poor, we shouldn't think that we're the heroes, but we're actually just going with a posture of getting on our knees and saying, I'm sorry that this was that inequality exists at all. So thanks.
Hey, thanks a lot for sharing. I just wonder, as I was hearing you talk about the problem of inequality and the problem of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and just distribution of resources and wealth. I guess these topics are pretty incendiary right now in the political world, especially in the Christian American scene. Can you tell any stories of having delivered the same message today in a much less receptive audience?
Thanks, brother. One of the things that I love about Jesus is I think that he was engaging everybody, right? Like, he wasn't limiting the Spirit of God to any political camp or theological camp. In fact, if you look at him, he's crossing every cultural barrier in the world. You know, he's got like Pharisees in dialogue going to their houses. He's got tax collectors and zealots. In case you didn't know, tax collectors and zealots didn't usually eat together. You know, like, actually, zealots killed tax collectors for fun on weekends. You know, and so, like, to actually have a dinner table where, like, he's kind of challenging the worst in every camp and pulling out the best in it, you know, I think that's absolutely beautiful. It's going like Gandhi said something about that. He said, if I have to choose between a coward and a soldier, I'll choose a soldier every day because their passion can be channeled into love, but I can do nothing with a coward. So I think there's something to why Jesus had zealots on board. That passion could be channeled into love and into, you know, transformation. And yet I also think, like, how quick we are, you know, to limit God to one political party or camp, and rather than to consistently challenge what needs to be challenged and to affirm what needs to be affirmed. One of my friends said, "What we do is we take the best in ourselves and we project it and exaggerate it, and we find the worst in others and we project that and exaggerate it, and so we pit the best in us against the worst in others, and it's not a fair fight. It's not even an honest fight, you know." So what Jesus teaches us is exactly the opposite: to look for the best in other people, and to find the worst hypocrisies or contradictions in ourselves, to work on the log in our own eye, you know, and that's what we can change. So we work on that, and I think that's what Dr. King and John Perkins and so many other folks have done, is they've like built relationships with folks who we don't agree with. So I appreciate the grace in your voice, brother, and I think that's part of what we do, is we keep a conversation going. And I'm thankful to God that this year I spoke at Liberty University, you know, Jerry Falwell's school. I spoke at Cedarville. I spoke at the American Enterprise Institute, the think tank for American capitalism. It was great. We had a like dialogue that was called, "Was Jesus a Communist or Capitalist?" It's fantastic. I said, "I don't think Jesus was anything that ended in ist. Jesus was a lover, you know, and Jesus was challenging all the categories." So I think that's what we need to be about, and we need to affirm the best in folks. And frankly, I think part of what's difficult is we're dealing with failed institutions and failed human creations, like political parties. You know, there's not any party that's ever going to fully capture the vision of Jesus, and so let's not misplace our hope. Let's make sure that it's firmly placed in Jesus, and then we call everything to move towards the vision of Jesus. And then I think we need to have conversations with folks that disagree with us. I mean, our critics are our best teachers, right? Like, you don't learn as much from your friends who just say amen to everything you say. Like, you learn from people who are like, "What are you thinking? You read this scripture? Are you done? You're like, what do you think about this?" So I think we got to be in those kind of conversations. But we've got to be gracious, and we've got to be on. You know, like I one of our priests in Camden. One of my buddies who was asking a real similar question to yours, he was like, "My family doesn't agree with me. They're always, you know, beating me on the head with political ideology. And what should I do?" And our priest, he's an Irish Catholic guy. He's so sweet. He's like, "What do you do with them? You could do lots of things. You could make them cookies. You could take them out for dinner. You could go for a walk in the park. But whatever you do, don't argue with them. Don't argue with him. He's like, that's not a good place to start. No one's been argued into a new way of believing very often, you know? So I think we build those friendships and we allow the Spirit to move in people and trust that it's the Spirit transforming hearts, not our good apologetics and arguments. So one or two more, and then we'll close. You can get come if you wear a dress. No, I'm just kidding. You can come. Yeah, we've seen a couple of guys. That's okay. Come on up. Yeah.
My name's Chris. It came to me when you were talking about when you were reading the parable, and I thought back to a quote from a Star Wars movie, and said
naturally.
And there's one point Obi-Wan Kenobi says to Anakin when Anakin's turning bad, only a Sith Lord talks in absolutes, Anakin. And sort of using that as a metaphor, relating it to Christianity a little bit, I don't know if I'm allowed to do that, but it seemed like the end of this parable sort of ended in an absolute a little bit, that this man who's in hell can't ever attain what Lazarus has. And that seemed, and I don't know, I was just kind of wondering what you have to say about thinking in absolutes, like is something always right or is something always wrong? And if you would, sort of my own personal thinking about this is if you do follow the thing that absolutes are always wrong, that's an absolute in and of itself. So I don't know where that takes you out.
Yeah, thanks, man. Well, I think we're out of time. I think you're onto something with those Star. You could have come out with a whole Star Wars Bible trend. No, I'm just kidding. I think that what stories are meant to do is they're meant to provoke us, you know, and I like how C.S. Lewis says that hell's locked from the inside, you know, that God's given us the keys through Christ, and as you read that story, you get the sense that, like, the rich man, like, he's the one who locked himself in. I mean, the brother owned the wall and the house and the gated neighborhood. He had the keys, you know, and so, like, what's so heartbreaking is that every day he tripped over this person and there was nothing in him that was alive enough to respond, you know? So I think that's what, to me, I read a story like that and it provokes in us, like let us have the eyes to see people who we've been made invisible. Let us have the eyes to see the hells that we lock ourselves in, the walls that we hide behind. Like that's the what the invitation that I see in this story. So I don't know if I've even said anything to your question, but that's what I hear as I read the story, and it's when I look at a lot of the stories of Jesus, like the other story with the rich man, where he comes up and says, "What do I need to do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "You got to sell everything you have and give it to the poor," you know, and the dude's like, "Oh man, I got a lot of stuff," you know, and like he walks away and Jesus lets him walk away, but he walks away of his own volition. Like he knew what he could do to be set free, you know? So what I think when I read these stories over and over is that it's not a matter of who's in and who's out. What it's about is the nature of the kingdom of God. Like it's not that the rich man can't come in. He's invited in, but in the kingdom, we don't have rich and poor. We only have family, and that means you've got to hold your possessions differently, because if not, then they're not your possessions. You're the one that's possessed by them, and they own you. They own your soul, and you can be set free. So that's what I take a lot of hope in, you know, because I think that no one is absolutely trapped. You know, anyone has the capacity to be moved by the pain of another person. Anyone has the capacity to be transformed by Christ. And that kind of grace is what I think Dr. King and Desmond Tutu and so many others say when they say over and over, they say that the revolution of God is big enough to set both the oppressed and the oppressors free. That this is not just about the poor. This is also about the rich. This is not just about slaves being set free, but slave owners being set free, because racism isn't good for anyone. So thanks be to God that we can all be set free. Does that feel like a good place to end, or anybody else itching to come up and share anything? Thanks, brother. Let me pray for us, because I think it's been a full day.
We have one more.
Great. Okay. Come on up. Represent, sister. All right. Come on.
I promise this will be a quick one. It's not a theological question. But we talked about Star Wars, so I thought I'd bring a little Lord of the Rings into it. So I wondered how you personally, what tactics you personally use to deal with burnout. Sometimes as I look at the broad scope of issues and disparities in our world, most of my friends know this, would like to just climb into a hobbit hole. And then I realize that coming from my position of having, being in my hobbit hole away from society isn't doing anything to help anything, so I vault myself back out of the hole. But it takes some strength to do that, and I was wondering, if through your work, what are some of the maybe simple tasks or some advice you have for us to not burn out too quickly?
I think that is a great and very practical place to think on as we close. And a few thoughts on it are, first of all, I think we've got to be around people whose courage and zeal and fire rubs off on us. You know, just like, I mean, all of us here growing up, you got to hang out with the right crowd, you know, like peer pressure. You know, I think there is an inertia towards negative things that can happen from a peer group, but there's also an inertia towards goodness, and there's an inertia towards love, that if we hang out with people who risk in beautiful ways, they teach us to live without fear. So I think part of what community is, and why at the heart of everything, is that we're doing this with some other people. You know, where two or three of you gather, I'm with you. Like this idea that we're to live in community. Because community is about surrounding ourselves with people who look like the person we want to become. You know, with folks that they live in daring ways. So almost everything people say, how do you get the courage to go to Iraq or Afghanistan? I'm like, I went with a bunch of people that had a lot of courage, and it rubbed off on me, you know. And when I got scared, I could talk to them about it. So when we do these things, like there are no lone rangers. We're called to do it together, and that gives us, I think, it continues to fire us up, just like the coals of a fire, you know, as you like. That you keep a fire warm by keeping the coals together. When you spread them out, you know, and they're lone ranger coals, they're just going to dwindle out. So I think it's the same way in our faith. We need to be, you know, stirred up by surrounding ourselves with folks whose faith is and whose love and whose recklessness for the gospel is a fire that heats us. And the other thing is, I think we've got to cultivate some holy habits, you know, that where goodness is kind of internalized in us. And Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker Movement, she said, we've got to create an environment where it's easier to be good. And that doesn't just happen. I think we need some holy habits. We need some rhythms for prayer. We need some to go through some periods where we unplug from stuff so that, like, we can take some of the things out of our life that suck life out of us. You know, we can replace them with some good stuff, like eating well and exercising and, like, praying together and singing and having fun. That's a part of it. I think a part of how, like, we stay alive and have fire is, like, because we have a little joy. That's one of the fruits of the Spirit, you know. So for me, I like living in a community with crazy people where, like, one of my favorite pranks was one night when I was asleep, they hung a life-size poster of George Bush above my bunk. And I woke up the next morning, and I was like, ah, God! You know, it's awesome. And but, like, that, it kept me laughing, you know. In fact, I left that poster there for months so I could pray for him. But that's the kind of, I think we need to laugh a little bit, you know. We need joy in the movement. As Emma Goldman said, if I can't dance, then it's not my revolution, you know. And if we've stopped laughing, then the devil's already won. And finally, I would say we need to keep a fresh love for Jesus alive, you know. That one of my friends who's been in this kind of work for ages and ages, decades and decades, I heard someone ask him, How do you keep hope and how do you keep energy for this? And he said, every morning, I was looking for this deep theological answer or something. He goes, every morning I crawl up into a little ball and I listen to Jesus whisper to me how much he loves me. And I remember that he loves the whole world that much. And so I think there's a part of us that really does have to remember that there's a God that loves us so deeply, and a God that loves the whole world. And the more we understand that, the other stuff gets a little bit easier. You know, if you know that you're loved, once you know that you're loved, we're set free in a lot of ways to encounter painful things and to bear burdens with other people. Because we also know that in the end, Jesus knew pain. Jesus knew poverty. Jesus knew violence really, really well. And he triumphed over them with love in his eyes. And he triumphed over them by rising from the dead to show that death is dead. Hatred is dead. Racism is dead. So we take courage from Jesus. And when I was in India, I kind of learned that. Every morning, the nuns, like, golly, in Calcutta, like, it was just work from, like, morning to night. But every day, we would have these times of prayer. And one of them was in the morning. Early in the morning, we would get up, and we would just kneel before Jesus. And we would, you know, they called it adoration, or that, you know, these times of prayer in the morning and in the evening. And every, we would take communion every morning. And I was like, this is different for me. You know, this is working some muscles I'm not used to. And I asked one of the nuns, I said, why do we take communion every morning? And she said, well, you've heard the saying, you are what you eat, right? I thought, yeah, I have, you know, and I know that's a little different to share about the Eucharist with a lot of Mennonites, but not everyone here is Mennonite tonight. But, you know, but that, like, regardless of how we think of the theological implications of the, you know, the Eucharist, I think what we can say is that when we spend time with God, a part of what we're doing is praying that God would live in us, you know, that God would live through us. And so then when we encounter really frustrating or really evil things during our days, what comes out of us is the fruits of the Spirit, you know, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. So that's my prayer, is that those would be the things that take root in us. And I think those are the things that we love about movements that have changed the world, is that they've mirrored God to us. So may it be so. Amen. Thanks so much for letting me spend the day with you, and thanks for all that you did today to honor Dr. King and to celebrate Jesus. Amen.